Thank you, Jennifer. I am aware that the invidious position I'm in today, speaking just before lunch. But thank you for the opportunity of making the journey over west. It's always enjoyable to come this way. But before I really address my topic of today about water markets and what makes water so different, or is it, I should just echo what Jennifer said about the, you know, the Water Corporation. As a water supply planner in the early, well, the late 90s on the East Coast, our first port of call when we were doing water plans was the Water Corporation, because Perth really was the canary in the coal mine when it came to the impacts of climate change on water supply systems. And now nationally and internationally, the Water Corporation are acknowledged as being the leaders in adaptation to climate change. And just recently there was a World Water Congress held in Vienna where Dr. Jim Gill, the CEO of Water Corporation, was awarded the grand prize for his leadership and vision in implementing measures to adapt to a drying climate. And also the Water Corporation received the key sustainability prize for its strategy on security through diversity. But anyway, let's really address the topic about water markets and why they currently don't exist in Australia. There's no shortage of reports circulating, whether it be from the Productivity Commission, the National Water Commission, and virtually every microeconomist in the country is writing papers about why can't we apply the electricity and the gas model to water? Why can't we open up the industry to provide more choice to consumers to make it more efficient? And this sort of begs the question about, well, why isn't it that there aren't water markets in Australia? Indeed, there are no water markets anywhere in the world that I'm aware of. And my basic premise of my short presentation today is that water is different to gas and electricity and a lot of other commodities. And just to preface that, water is unique amongst all the commodities in the way it, you know, runs through the land, the rivers, the oceans and the atmosphere, and touches every part of our environment. The other commodities don't. The second point to say, just as an introduction, is that water is expensive to transport in relation to its value. You can buy a tonne of water here in Perth for 64 cents, and that gets delivered to your home 24/7 every day of the year. Now, can anyone name me one other commodity you can buy anything of for a tonne that weighs 64 cents? If you're prolific with your water, the next year, from 150 kilolitres to 300, goes up to 83 cents. I beg you again to identify any product that's as cheap as that. But water is incredibly heavy, and of course a kilolitre of water does weigh a tonne. But the other thing, which I'll get right to at the end, is that there's a spiritual side of water which makes it fundamentally different. And this is because it's an essential part of life and it touches all aspects of our existence on this planet. And because of that spiritual side, water debates and the water issues have incredible passion, and well, invoking incredible passion and empathy out there in the community, which is why community consultation, as Sue has just mentioned, is a key part of all our water resource planning. I don't know about you, but I don't know, too many people that get worked up around a dinner table about gas molecules or electrons and things like that. But certainly water does invoke, does invoke those kind of reactions in a way that other commodities don't do. So that's my general premise, that water is different. But let me say, that doesn't mean that everything has to stay the same forever. It just means that we need to go into this with our eyes open. But a little bit of history. The reason that the industry is able to tackle the significant challenges of climate change right across Australia really gets back to the 1994 COAG reforms. And I've summarised what they were there, and I'm not going to go into that. But these reforms have really put the Australian urban water industry on a front that it was probably the envy of most of the rest of the world. And, you know, you should be reminded, you know, we take for granted our metering and charging for volumetric, water use and things like that. In the UK, only 30% of properties have water meters. They, you know, the rest of the properties over there still pay for water on the value of, based on the value of the property. So how's that? And the annual benchmarking through the National Performance Report, there's 150 KPIs that, you know, the industry reports on. We now, you know, price water, particularly in the capital cities, so we've got retained earnings that fund quite significant capital investment programs. The only one of these reform milestones that wasn't met back in 1994 was the inclusion of externalities in water prices, and that was just too hard then because no one knew anything about it. But if you think about it, in a number of capital cities, we already charge for water above the long-run marginal cost, so implicitly there is an externality price built into the water prices. But what hasn't happened since the 1994? Well, there's been no privatisation of any water utility in Australia. However, there is substantial private sector involvement in the industry. For the previous water minister at the federal level, I did some numbers for Malcolm Turnbull about 18 months or 2 years ago using the major capital cities. Over 90% of the capital works budgets in the major utilities are contracted out to the private sector, and between about 60 to 70% of the OPEX budgets are contracted out to third-party providers. So there's already a high degree of involvement of the private sector in the industry. However, there's no third-party access, despite the fact that there's, Part 3 of the Trade Practices Act has always, allowed that for quite a considerable period of time. New South Wales just recently introduced the Water Industry Competition Act. But I think it's significant also about third-party access. I'm not aware of one third-party access scheme around the globe either. Certainly the threat of third-party access has driven down water prices in the UK in a number of instances for industry, but I'm not aware of any third-party access projects. And of course there's been no introduction of direct competition in potentially contestable areas, and that's what I'm going to address in the next few minutes. And we still rely on restrictions rather than prices to clear the markets. And I think it's the bluntness of restrictions that has frustrated people around Australia into thinking there's got to be a better model. And you may not be aware that there's quite harsh restrictions on over in the East Coast compared to what you've got in, your water-saving rules here. And people want more choice in when they water their garden, at what times, and what they use the water for. Restrictions are seen to be inequitable, that they only address outside use, and you stay in the shower all day if you want to. And so this is what's driven a lot of microeconomists to put their heads into their, develop their econometric models to say, well, is there a different way and a different model for delivering water? Well, is it different to gas and electricity? My argument is yes, it is. First reason, water can be stored cheaply in reservoirs and aquifers. Electricity can't be stored. And, of course, I'm assuming there that it actually rains. The second point being, and this I covered this, transport costs are incredibly intensive and heavy for water compared to electricity, where the electrons just run along and, of course, gas can be compressed. And what this means is that you'll never get national water markets or state water markets because of the prohibitive costs of transporting water. You don't have to pump water very far to make a desalination plant look attractive from an energy point of view. The next one is the high transmission losses with pipe water systems compared to gas and electricity. It's a fallacy to think that just because the water's in a pipe that there's no transmission losses. We all know that that's not the case. And, of course, there are quality issues. I'm particularly aware of quality issues with gas, but I think that the issues with water are more profound. than what they are with electricity and gas. And, you know, Water Corporation, as it already exists, has significant challenges in managing taste and odour and other, you know, aesthetic aspects of water quality because of the multiple sources of water it's already got. And so we should never, ever forget that, you know, water quality is one of those things that we could never compromise on. The reliability of supply. Well, you know, you heard the story this morning. When you've got a dam and you're relying on surface runoff, you don't really have a bankable quantity of water. You never, ever know under the end of the filling season where you're at and what you've got to sell the following summer. Now, gas and electricity production is generally more reliable. I would have had the generally out of there if it hadn't been for the Western Australian gas issue. So it's sort of a little bit less reliable than what it used to be, but nevertheless, more reliable than a dam, let me tell you. The next point is that, you know, with gas and electricity, once it's produced and it gets into the system, that's it. You can forget about it. But with water, you know, there's environmental issues in the extraction. Once you put it into the system, it ends up as wastewater and it's got to be disposed of, and there's the whole issue of the river health and the whole issue of recycle and the yields and things like that. So you really need to manage it as the whole water cycle. And it's become clear in recent years that optimum resource outcomes will only be achieved in urban water when we look at the whole water cycle and look at the storm water, the wastewater and the potable water and the recycled water in an integrated manner. The days of looking at these things in silos are really over. And I think you'd have to say, well, how difficult is it going to be to get a market working in that complexity? And, of course, the reason that the water industry exists is because of public health. We really are in the public health industry, and I was pleased to hear that the new minister is a medico, so he would understand the fact that drinking water really is the raison d'etre of the urban water industry, and in many respects, the water industry engineers have saved more lives than the medicos ever will through sanitation and drinking water, and we can never compromise that. So really, what's up for grabs? Well, when you look at it, not a lot. Because the transport infrastructure in water compared to electricity and gas is significantly greater. Now, that transport infrastructure is a natural monopoly part of the system. So you're not going to be running around Perth putting in dual pipelines or anywhere putting in dual pipelines, which means it's only really in the production area that you're going to be able to, you know, open it up and get some competition. Now, this has led to a lot of academics and economists calling for scarcity pricing to be the panacea to sort of solve the so-called urban water crisis around Australia. Well, let me tell you, one of the things they never ever tell you about is what it might mean in terms of peak prices. Now, there is scarcity pricing in the electricity market, but it's only at the wholesale market. It's very muted, and the average consumer in the household wouldn't even know that it existed. This won't be the case with urban water, let me tell you. Now, ABARE did a study which was put out about 2 months ago based on Canberra. Now, it assumed price elasticity of, you know, minus 0.05. Now, I think that that's incredibly high. I think it's more likely to be down around 0.2. But nevertheless, even with that high elasticity of demand that they've used, they calculate that the price of water would go from a dollar when the dams were overflowing up to $12 a kilolitre once the dams got below 40%. Now, it's more likely, I think, that if you put the correct elasticities of demand in there, it would go, you know, go well over $20 a kilolitre. And these models always assume that in 2 or 3 years' time, it'll rain and the dams will be full and the price will drop down, just like the price of bananas dropped after the cyclone. And that, or you can bring on a bit of investment to supplement the supply of water, and so people won't have to endure these prices for very long at all. Let me tell you, if we'd have had scarcity pricing across Australia's capital cities, people would have been paying that and higher for water for at least the best part of a decade now, while we rapidly build the new water systems, which Sue and others have spoken about this morning. So just sort of bringing the whole contestable market issue to a conclusion, it doesn't exist anywhere in the world that we're aware of, so there's nowhere you can go and look to see how it works and what the mistakes are and how you avoid perverse outcomes. It's certainly unlikely to work anywhere, everywhere across Australia, because the institutional arrangements vary from state to state, and the last place you'd want to introduce it is in local government management of water. They really require amalgamation more than breaking up the market. But we need to do a lot of work before we proceed. The then Industry Commission did a 12-month study on electricity privatisation, and they looked at which were the natural monopoly elements of the system, which parts of the system could be open to contest, who was going to be the supplier of last resort, and how could you prevent perverse outcomes. This work has not been done for the urban water industry. And just finally, I'm just wondering how many policymakers would be comfortable with the price fluctuations you would get if we did move down that scarcity pricing path. So in conclusion, you know, a one-size-fits-all is not going to work. These markets haven't been developed, probably because a large part of the urban water industry is a natural monopoly. I think that we've got to build this model on utilities are performing strongly, and as I've said, I'd be picking some of the capital city utilities to do the study, some as well, rather than the regional utilities or local government utilities. The regulatory regimes need to recognise, as I said, the public health, social, and environmental and economic values of water. And the private sector will continue to play an important role, as I've already lined up. But I'll get back to my point about, well, you know, what, you know, the spiritual aspects of, you know, water, and why is it that Australians are obsessed with water, we're obsessed with climate, and it's a common dinner table conversation? Well, I think it's for a number of reasons. So first, some social research done recently shows that water is perceived as being a natural or a primary resource, whereas gas and electricity is perceived as being a manufactured or an industrial resource. The second point is people have an incredibly good understanding of water and water supply systems. They know very, very little about gas and electricity systems. This is the reason why there's so many water experts around. You know, everyone's a water expert because they all understand water. And I also think that the reason there's so much interest in water is because climate change, I should say, is that when people express their concerns about climate change, more often than not, it's code for their concern about water, because water shortages are one of the most visible and tangible manifestations that our climate has changed. And just one other quick point before I go about the differences about the social side of water is that if you look at Sydney, Sydney now uses the same amount of water as what it did in 1974, with an additional 1.2 million people living in that city. Electricity consumption, on the other hand, has doubled in that time. Now, why is this so? And I think it gets back to all these things about water. You know, naturalness is a powerful thing, and people like, you know, the thought of products being natural. And it's the fact that water touches so many of people's emotions and passions. Our vocabulary is rich in water metaphors. And also, just finally, in conclusion, why was it that the previous federal government privatised a whole range of government enterprises while they were in power, but they blinked when it came to the Snowy Mountain and water? And I think it gets down to that, water being the quintessential social, political and economic commodity. Thank you.